It's one of my favorite pieces. That's Thad Jones on trumpet opening up on Midnight Walk, the title track from drummer brother Elvin Jones's 1966 album, and it's one of my favorites. Abdullah Ibrahim on piano, Don Moore on bass, and George Abend on percussion. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead, and here we are on the eve of the big event, one of the most contentious presidential elections in U.S. history, and we still don't know what to make of it. We'll just have to wait and see. The nation, however, finds itself being coaxed into barreling through this bitter contest and bringing it to a close and moving on to a brand new administration. But few believe election 2016 to be a fair fight. Even fewer believe it to be an insult to the democratic process. In effect, election 2016 has been a never-ending saga of political twists and turns, and the star of the show has not been substantive issues and the political questions that people want settled, but rather various levels and categories of wrongdoing, including major crimes. In election 2016, voters have been converted into really jurors, weighing the guilt or innocence of the contestants. There's much on their plate to consider when we look at the major candidates. We've been focusing on candidate Clinton and her long and documented history of scandals, shady dealings, and even organized crime. And yet she seems to benefit from an extraordinary level of political protection. With what has been revealed by the charity fraud expert Charles Ortel and the WikiLeaks documents that have been released so far about the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Foundation, and about Clinton's political history, the question is, how will the jury vote tomorrow? Charles Ortel joins us again today. There has been another batch of emails released. We'll catch up with those in a minute and see what else has been revealed on the eve of election 2016. Thanks for being with us again today, Charles.
It's my great pleasure, Utrice. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with this idea that we aren't so much voters this year, but rather jurors. We're deciding the relative guilt or innocence of the parties involved. And that's a sad place to be, considering this is the land of democracy and freedom and all of that kind of stuff. But here we are, a leading nation in the world, community of nations. And essentially, this whole spectacle has come down to who is less offensive, who is less criminal, who is less likely to take this, to take us down the wrong path. What are your views?
Well, you know, I think it's a little bit too soon to see 2016 in the type of perspective that historians will flesh out for us in time. But if we look back, you know, I began working in 1980 after getting out of graduate school in that year. And I remember as a teenager feeling that nothing was going right in the late 60s and 70s. And the world seemed to be, you know, blowing apart. The economy was in horrible shape. Inner cities were in turmoil. America's place in the world was, you know, far from, let's say, elevated. And, you know, then we had that long period of the 80s, 1982 to 99, let's say, where it seemed like America, you know, course, he made mistakes along the way, but from an economic standpoint, there was tremendous growth, tremendous job creation, tremendous income generated and wealth generated for you know, many, many people. And then geopolitically, America was on top of the world, particularly, I would argue, from 92 to about 99, 2000. For the young voting population, the people who today are, let's say, less than 40 or less than 35, they and we have never known in the period 2000 forward, a period where the United States economy has been strong and or we have not been at war. I mean, in every single year since really 99, 2000, when the tech bubble blew up, the economic situation has been highly unstable and uncertain, and we've been at war around the world, and it doesn't seem to be working. I mean, when you get into history books and you look and see what this great country did in 1939 to 1944, the sacrifices that that generation, referred to as the greatest generation, made on all of our behalf, that transcended many lives, and the magnitude and scale of that sacrifice relative to economic activity and what they achieved in really four short years on the heels then, starting in 39, of a multi-year depression, something we may not, I hope, ever encounter again, but which was devastating, is a remarkable story. And yet here, from a much stronger economic base, 1998-99, after the events of dread events of 2001 September, this country just can't seem to catch a break. And the people that some of us listen to and count or have counted as experts have failed us, whether they're people who come at issues from the left or people or from the right or from the center, from academia, from business, billionaires, paupers, you name it. Nothing that we seem to try has worked. And the economic figures, such as they are, they're all based on surveys. They show that incomes, which I think are really the driving underpinning for economic prosperity, incomes are either falling or at best stagnant in every sector of the economy, whether you're in the top 20%, the middle, the bottom. Everybody is worse off. Politicians are devising these bigger and bigger, you know, grand schemes that chiefly seem to involve their full-time employment and their ability subsequently to go on these high-paid speeches and get sweetheart inside deals. But none of these solutions are working. And so I think what we're seeing here, there are some common themes. I think in the movement behind Bernie Sanders, which didn't make it across the finish line, we saw the depth of dissatisfaction on the left with the traditional Democratic Party, as I'd say, embodied by the Clinton wing, or the Clinton machine of the Democratic Party. In the right, I mean, I think historians will in the end marvel that somebody who, you know, even I once thought was pretty much of a rube, a carnival barker, you know, and somebody who came close to bankruptcy in the 90s could emerge, you know, in theory a multi-billionaire as an advocate for populists and smash the Bush wing of the Republican Party, every single established wing of the Republican Party. So there's common and widespread dissatisfaction with the status quo. And I think very few of us, and even those clinging, you know, in the shadows to all the gains they've derived through this period, the very, very wealthy among us, even they will admit there's something ain't right. And that's what this election is all about. I think it's an election where we're going to see whether this corrupt establishment, the Bush wing of the Republican Party, the Clinton wing of the Democratic Party, the media who support them, the bankers who feast off them, the lobbyists who feast off, whether that corrupt establishment is going to keep us all in thrall, or whether we're going to see a wave election that will surprise everybody. And I got to tell you, I mean, I'm not a political expert. I did study politics, you know, long ago in a different galaxy far, far away in the 1970s, college. But I got to say, I really sense that on substance it's a wave election. Now, who knows the magnitude of the fraud? There will be, you know, vote suppression and there will be vote stuffing, and who knows how that all plays out across the country. But I'll give you an anecdote, Utrice, for your listeners. I walk everywhere here in Manhattan it's my exercise. You know, I even walk in bad weather. And I remember in 2008, I live in the West Village, in the heart of the West Village, which is a prosperous place and very left-leaning. And I remember in 2008, long before the election, everywhere you look, there were Obama stickers everywhere, in storefronts, in cars, in townhouses, apartment buildings, everywhere you looked. And as we approached the voting day, there were proud Obama stickers, pins, or whatever. I just walked from all through Greenwich Village, 2 miles uptown, and I did not see a single Hillary button or sticker or anything anywhere. So on her side, there does not, I mean, that's just hardly a scientific survey, but, you know, I just don't see any public displays of affection for Hillary in the heart of this city, largest and most economically important city inside the state she represented as a senator for 8 years. I don't see any visible signs of enthusiasm for her, which is interesting. I don't expect to see signs for Trump, but I certainly would expect, you know, the young girls and mothers and others saying, isn't this great? We've got a woman. She's going to be president of the United States. I don't see enthusiasm for her. And I wonder if there isn't a quiet volcano building here where, you know, amongst the on the right and on the left, frankly, that people might just say, you know, we really need a change agent and everyone's flawed. Let's try something different, you know. And I wonder if that isn't what we're going to end up seeing here. And I went back and I checked what happened in 1980 overnight. And, you know, if you look carefully at it, all of the wise guys, smart pundits, and wise women, smart pundits in 1980 were saying, even right before the election, that Reagan didn't have a prayer. And Reagan picked some serious posterior in that election. And he won California, and he won New York, which is amazing. He won pluralities in both states. I think he won more than 40 different states. I believe he won close to more than 460 electoral votes, and nobody expected that. Now, I'm not saying Trump's going to do that, but I don't think the election results will be known by 9 p.m. tomorrow.
Well, you know, it's an interesting parallel that you raised here, because if we were to follow that historical perspective, then we have to kind of recalibrate our opinions about Hillary Clinton, because up until just a couple of days ago, things didn't look good for her at all with these emails and the scandals again, the question about the illegalities that the Clinton Foundation has been consistently involved in, her conflict of interest as Secretary of State, and basically the dollar of favors globally for people who are willing to, quote, donate to the foundation. Things look pretty odd. And then, what do you know? She is given a new lease on life by James Comey. It seemed that for a while that she was finished. And James Comey, for the second time, relating to this new batch of emails that were discovered on the laptop of her chief aide, Uma Abedin's estranged husband's laptop, 650,000 emails. And we hear miraculously they were all gone through, they were examined, and Mr. Comey, the FBI director, announced that there's nothing new here. Move along, nothing to see here. And today, most of the papers that I'm reading in the news reports are salivating over the fact that the dollar seems to have risen in value just on that news. So, you know, it just never ends. How do you explain that? I mean, what is happening here?
Well, I think what's happening here is that the establishment, those would be the people with all the money, view a Trump presidency as an uncontrollable set of variables. And so they know that Hillary is bankable. They know that it is possible to, you know, to get the policies in place and keep the status quo, a low interest rate environment, that they can have tremendous influence over. So they view Hillary, I think, as the preferred candidate, and Trump not. Now, I would caution that the media play today, which is, I would agree, very pro-Hillary, the media interpretation of the Comey letter is dangerously flawed. A close reading of that letter states not that they reviewed 650,000 emails. It says that they reviewed all emails to and from Hillary Clinton solely during the period when she was Secretary of State. So in the first instance, we don't know how many emails there are before that and how many emails there are after that. And in the second instance, we don't know how many emails there were that were not to and from Hillary, but, you know, involving her indirectly through her various aides. So we don't know all of that. And, you know, this is what Comey was talking about back to July 5th, 2016, was not the entirety of everything that the FBI is looking at, but merely the public corruption aspects. It's one small portion of the case. And my sources tell me that the Clinton, not just because I'm so much focused on the Clinton Foundation, but, you know, various and sundry sources I do have tell me that the Clinton Foundation case is by far bigger than the email public corruption case. So, yes, it is on the one hand good for her in the sense that he's backed off his position of whatever it is 10, 11 days ago. But on the other hand, you know, when it comes to Comey, I'm a various mind. Initially, I had heard through the sources just what we all have heard in the public, that this is a great man, you know, a ramrod straight, man of high integrity. Well, when you look more closely into the history of his career, he did spend time working at Lockheed, making a lot of money there, gigantic defense contractor. He did work, who, by the way, is implicated, at least for some study in these various emails around the arms deals that may have gone Lockheed and other defense contractors' way while Hillary was Secretary of State. And then you have his involvement with HSBC, a large global bank that had a huge problem in Switzerland, some Clinton Foundation donors, Americans and others, contributing from a Swiss-based bank account when maybe they shouldn't have had that Swiss-based bank account. And arguments some have made on the left and the right that the settlement our Department of Justice exacted against HSBC was not as tough as it might have been. So there are questions about Comey. And, you know, I got to say, I'm not a lawyer. I'm just sort of a practical dude. I don't get shutting the inquiry down July 5th and then reopening it late in October under a theory that it must be something major, only to turn around and shut it back down again, you know, days later. The decisions are they're inconsistent and therefore inexplicable to me. I just don't get it. And it gives you, I think, on balance, I can tell you from the people who wouldn't allow me to stay off the phone yesterday after the decision happened until about 11 at night, the people reaching out to me from around the world were furious and were not assuaged by, you know, the theory that this means anything positive for the end of an investigation. They just thought it signaled to the world that, indeed, as Trump has been saying, and as others on the left have long been saying, the system is rigged. That's the impression you're given. I mean, how does the former president of the United States, whose wife is a target, and he may be a target of an inquiry, how does he arrange to meet alone with a sitting attorney general, a lady, a fine lady, I'm told, whom he appointed back when he was president? How does he get off doing that moments before, days before the director of the FBI announces an end to the inquiry? And how does he get off doing something that is so obviously suspicious and unusual and out of procedure, out of the procedures that normally are followed in the supposedly fair administration of justice? He shouldn't have done that. And I think, you know, the sentiment I'm seeing, and I may not be seeing things objectively, is that people are just sick and tired. As you rightly point out in the beginning, Patrice, you know, the jury is sick and tired of hearing excuses, grand, vague plans. The jury wants results. And I'm not saying that I know Trump can deliver results, but I'm very certain that Hillary Clinton cannot.
Well, it's also an interesting thing that has occurred, and which makes the jury, if you will, far more entitled to have its opinion. I mean, you have transforming in front of our eyes. I mean, the head of the Justice Department transfers her authority to an investigative body, which is now acting as a prosecutorial agency. And this is amazing to me, that the head of the FBI, which still stands for, as far as I know, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, not prosecution, but investigation. Their job is to investigate and hand over the evidence to the Justice Department so that the Justice Department could do its job. The Federal Bureau of Investigation has no authority to prosecute anybody. But we have the head of the Justice Department conferring, just arbitrarily conferring, her authority, her designated authority to prosecute to an investigative body. And that investigative body, in turn, has said no reasonable prosecutor will proceed with the prosecution of this case. It's mind-boggling. So we have the arbitrary changing of the constitutional law here, that by law, the Federal Bureau of Investigation is just supposed to go gather the evidence and then turn it over to the Justice Department, whose singular job is prosecuting. But this is an amazing twist of things, and I just don't get it. Well, let's take a look at what happened last night with the latest release of emails by WikiLeaks. What have you learned? What are some of the major points that came to your attention?
All right. So there are two sets of leaks that have happened. One, last night, there were slightly more than 8,000 new emails came out. And those have to do chiefly with the Democratic National Committee. It's a second batch of emails, and it's not one that I'm necessarily necessarily the target of what I'm looking at. But I have noticed that there seem to be quite a few examples that are in the press now, and that you can see for yourself, of the Democratic National Committee colluding with CNN and colluding with other elements in the press, and it does not paint a good picture either of the DNC or of its relationships with the mainstream media. I mean, I'm not a journalist. I thought, however, that the journalist was supposed to be the fourth estate. It was supposed to be independent and represent the interests of the public and ask the tough questions on behalf of the public. That the moneyed interests and the political interests, the established interests, didn't necessarily want to have to answer. I was unaware that the mainstream media had become instead now apparently a tool of one political party. I wouldn't like to see them be a tool of the Republican Party or the Democratic Party or any party. I thought, and I remember back in the day, maybe 20 years ago or 30 years ago, we did have a mainstream media that was prepared to follow the trail wherever it led. And that's indeed where, in theory, the New York Times started back in, 1896, the search for the truth without fear, from any quarter. And that's certainly not what you see in these emails. And then some of it's kind of amusing, where you see people trying to stay on the good side of the Democrats, volunteering their services to suggest tough questions that, Wolf Blitzer might want to ask Donald Trump. It seemed almost comical, the way in which they were interacting. And then, you could say what we want about the Republican Party, but the characters in it, but they did go through a process whittling down 17 different candidates to one. and we can, you know, obviously each of the candidates has strengths and weaknesses. Do we really believe, looking back at the 2015-2016 period, that we have had a searching inquiry into the pros and cons of the best people who might have been brought out from the Democratic Party apparatus to try to go up against Mr. Trump? Or was Hillary Clinton just basically stuffed down the throats of the electorate in the Democratic Party? And, you know, I'm not going to join or get active in either party. But I got to say, I think it's better for the country if we're going to have a two-party system that each party go through a real vetting process and test the mettle of, you know, the best people who might stand up there and aspire to lead this country in the free world. And I got to say, and I'm, you know, not objective about it, but I certainly don't think the Democratic Party did that. I think Bernie Sanders was robbed. I think that's what these emails show. I wonder when the robbing part process started. I wonder, you know, now looking at this, how serious was Bernie, and how serious were the team behind Bernie about really letting him go the distance? Because, you know, without going through the minutia of every primary, in primary after primary, he was robbed.
That's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it would be to raise questions now, because I certainly did. In the very beginning, I said, I don't understand how the people of this movement, if they bothered at all to look at the history of such movements, Jesse Jackson's, Dennis Kucinich's, Barack Obama's, could now just go ahead and repeat those errors with Bernie Sanders. There was no contract, really, worked out between those people who were going to be supporting him and him. So there was nothing to tie him and make him accountable even to his own movement. And from what I've read of the WikiLeaks releases, it seems to suggest that very early in the process, Bernie Sanders made an accommodation with the Democratic Party, and essentially to give the effect of just what you're talking about, that it isn't just a predetermined that Hillary Clinton will emerge as the candidate, but hey, here's somebody else who is also in the game. And then, of course, we know that he capitulated and still has not been made accountable by that move. It's a sore point with me. I've talked about it here a lot on the program. But it seems to suggest that Bernie Sanders, because some of the documents that I read indicated having meetings early with Bernie Sanders about, we don't know the specifics, but it would seem to me that they had approached him very early in the game about the possibility of him basically coming to Hillary's side.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm going to make a comment here. I'm being half joking and maybe more than half serious, if that's possible. But if you look at Hillary, I mean, the whole Democratic primary thing, it was pretty expensive. You know, there are people who rightly bellyache about wasting money on flying around and travel and the impact that has on the environment. You know, if you think about how many people drove and flew, how many hundreds of thousands and millions of miles to stay in, how many hotel rooms to go to, you know, how many other rooms that had to be heated and cooled and all this kind of stuff. If all we were going to do is just have a coronation, why did we go through that mess? I mean, think about the harmful impact to the environment of that process. Honestly, the millions of people who were driving and flying and staying up there, you know, if it was just going to be a fait accompli, why did we waste all that time, money, and energy? You know, it just seems ridiculous to me. And I do take the point, though, and wonder, I mean, whether Bernie was ever really serious about taking it all the way, or whether it was just yet another con job. You know, whether he was in on the con, or what stage did he become in on the con? Perhaps, as a guess, when he stood up there early on in one of those debates and said, you know, who cares about the damn emails, I had grave concerns at that point about him. Because I would have thought he would have, if he were a serious candidate, he would have exploited that issue far more than he did.
And even now, you can see in hindsight, of course, 2020 vision, we tend to have that in hindsight. There were indications that he was just not as aggressive about certain things when he had every right to be. Plus, he would have had the support of a wider audience and taking in more people from, you know, the disaffected from the other parties. And he would have had a very solid cudgel, really, to get some attention within the democratic process in this 2016 election. But he chose not to, and this is something that has to be looked at much more deeply. What else did you learn from looking at the documents released last night?
Well, the ones released last night, I didn't really dwell on quite as much, Teresa, as the ones that came out this morning, which are a continuation of the stream that has been out now. I guess this is dump 33. There's another 3,000 emails that came out sometime this morning. And those I have looked at, and there's no nuclear weapon bombshell that I see yet. But there are more and more emails streaming out here that do seem to show. There's one in particular recounting a meeting that a Clinton Foundation person had with ambassadors of, I think, four or five countries, summarizing, while Hillary was still Secretary of State, listing off the various projects that the foundation might pursue, that the Clinton family might pursue, all this information gleaned in the guise of work for the foundation in meetings introduced through the good offices of the Secretary of State. So, and it's a very lengthy email involving, from memory now, Peru, projects in Peru, Malawi, Qatar, Brazil, and I think Rwanda. And, you know, that's just wrong. You shouldn't be, and, you know, I, in a past life, I was an investment banker at the time that my former big boss was the Treasury, the Secretary of the Treasury, and I would go down and meet with him periodically when I was in Washington, D.C., but at no time did we ever discuss any aspect of business. Anyway, you just would dream back, this was in the 1980s, early 1990s, of going in and saying, all right, Nick, this is Nick Brady I'm talking about. You know, we'd like to do this business deal, but can you give us some help from the Treasury Department? I mean, you wouldn't even be allowed into the meeting to discuss that. But here it looks like what the foundation was doing was basically a business development operation. You know, you use Hillary Clinton to get you a high-level meeting with the ambassador, core ambassadors of these various governments that have projects they can unlock in their home countries. And so you get the door pushed open by the relationship that Hillary has with the ambassadors, and then you meet with the ambassadors to discuss these business projects. And if any of them have any charitable purpose, maybe you do some of that in the foundation, but you let Doug Band and others allied to the Clintons go off and monetize these contacts. And this is just not allowed. It's public corruption, sure looks like. And then it's, in addition to that, it's what's called inurement. It's when those in position exercise significant influence over a foundation, use the foundation to create private gains and appropriate those gains for themselves. It's strictly criminal behavior. And so there's a lengthy memo to that effect. There's this sad memo in 2012 concerning Rwanda. And, of course, you know, Rwanda is one of those countries that in history, perhaps like Haiti, cannot seem to catch a break. You know, every several decades or so, there's one group massacres another group, and there have been health crises and all kinds of problems in Rwanda. And apparently what happened, if you read this memo, which is quite lengthy, the Clinton Foundation became involved in Rwanda, I think by 2005 or so. And a gentleman came along, Sir Tom Hunter, I think his name is, who promised that he would get really active and put a lot of money and made an extravagant pledge, frankly, to the Clinton Foundation that he could fund. So they start funded fully because of the financial crisis. He made the pledge before the crisis bit hard in 2008-09. And the projects had advanced. And this is a memo recounting, you know, how badly awry the projects had gone and how basically what started as a foreign aid effort inside Rwanda turned into a business proposition run by local Rwandan interests that were corrupt. And it was a reputational nightmare. And here's a memo about, you know, what should we do? And it just really embarrassing details, further proving the long litany of details that have been coming out. Now, another one that happened actually over the weekend in this stream of the Podesta, so-called Podesta emails, was an accusatory email from Doug Band that's all over the press today, suggesting that the foundation had been used as basically a slush fund to fund the high living of Chelsea, including paying for her extravagant wedding in 2010. Now, that's getting a lot of press today, as it should. And I guess there are other accusations made by Doug Band, who's, you know, clearly hostile at the time to Chelsea, suggesting that the foundation monies or monies inside the foundation were also advanced to Chelsea for living expenses, for high living expenses, and as compensation for her campaigning. So it's, you know, one disgruntled rival spreading dirt in these emails against Chelsea that dirt needs to be explained, because you can use in a family business, people often squabble about where the money goes. And in a family business, of course, the owners of the business understand that you don't want to waste money on expenses because that really harms the capital value of the business. So there are controls on a business that's family controlled against this type of wasteful spending. In a foundation, you're not supposed to use a foundation as a piggy bank to pay for extravagant weddings that certainly have nothing to do with it being a presidential archive and research facility based in Little Rock. So that got a lot of print, as it, I think, richly deserved, and will get a lot of print going forward.
What is also beginning to get some traction is, you know, President Obama being put under the microscope and the questions about what role did he play in enabling this incredible amount of larceny and just insane actions that were covered up, and that his administration appears to have shielded her from.
Exactly. Exactly. There is starting to be, there are memos that come out, and I think we talked a little bit. Actually, we may not have talked too much about the Kumiki Gibson memo, I don't think, you, Trace, did we?
No.
We did not. So that memo came out. Yeah, that memo came out on Saturday. Now, that is a devastating memo. That is a 17 or 19 page memo dated November 10th, 2008. So November 10th, 2008 is several days after Barack Obama won the election. Those are heady times. It was a historic time. And it seems that beginning in September 2008, this lady who used to be a partner at Williams & Connolly, the very powerful law firm that originally was involved creating the Clinton Foundation in 1997, this lady is hired, I think it seems in her personal capacity, to do a study of the state of the Clinton Foundation. And here's the study that comes back. There's a draft that's now in these papers, and it's gotten a lot of attention, where it basically says the foundation it doesn't use the words fraud, but it says it is not in compliance with applicable law. And then it recounts in great details all the many defects. those of us who understand the details around a charity, it's describing a husk, a charity that's a complete mess. It is not compliant, therefore it can't operate properly. It doesn't have controls. Financials are a mess. There's also internal problems. There's a whiff of there's no sexual harassment policy, and there's suggestions that that might have been going on in this memo. Subsequently, the lady, Ricky Gibson, involved, has a resume in which she boasts about defending the foundation from a workplace lawsuit. Yet, 6 days later, after this memo was drafted, Valerie Jarrett affixes her signature to a draft memorandum of understanding supposedly regulating the Clinton Foundation, potential conflicts of the Clinton Foundation with the incoming Barack Obama administration. And what the memo that she signed describes a different foundation. It describes the foundation as wonderful. You know, every aspect of it is grand. All the accomplishments are cited. It's in full compliance. And that's just not the case. So you look at these two memos 6 days apart and you say to yourself, Valerie Jarrett cannot possibly have seen that memo, because if she had seen that memo by the time she was asked to sign the memorandum of understanding 6 days later, she wouldn't have signed it. So
now this all has I'm just interjecting. This all has to do with Obama considering, in fact, this was the demand. It was demanded that Hillary Clinton be named Secretary of State. And as part of the process, people are supposedly, quote, vetted, unquote. At this time, the foundation was an absolute total in chaos. Every aspect that this memo addresses confirms how completely chaotic the situation was at the Clinton Foundation, which had observed practically none of the operating principles that they were supposed to. And yet, this was a document that was supposed to have vouched for Hillary Clinton as a very capable administrator, and everything was, the foundation was the epitome of a lawful, a law-abiding entity. However, the question raised here is, did Hillary Clinton even put Obama on the spot by lying to him and to lying to the through the process of saying, oh, there's nothing wrong with me that would prevent me from assuming this job, which, of course, had already been prearranged. So continue.
Yeah, and so it looks to me as if, I mean, I don't know either most of these people, but, Valerie Jarrett has a reputation for being a smart lady. She's a lawyer, went to good colleges, and held lots of positions of great responsibility. It sure seems to me as if the Clintons were bold enough to take an incoming administration, a team that had defeated them, and to lie to them, to withhold this key piece of information, to enter into a sham discussion. Mind you, this memo is so devastating that the proper approach, it was sent to the CEO of the Clinton Foundation, Bruce Lindsay, who signed ultimately the memorandum of understanding on behalf of the Clinton Foundation with Jarrett. All right, so he knowingly signed a memorandum of understanding that lied materially about the state of the Clinton Foundation. When he ultimately signed, I think Valerie signed on the 16th of November, 2008, and Bruce signed it on the 12th of December, 2008. So he knowingly lied. Valerie, for some reason, didn't feel it was necessary to do the type of deep diving into the foundation, a very complex entity whose finances actually and filings were not made on time. The filings for 2007 were due by November 16th, 2008. They were not filed on a timely basis. They were filed after the final filing deadline, which is technically not allowed in New York. And They then set about the Obama administration and the Clintons, lying to her fellow senators, lying about the state of the foundation, not disclosing this material set of huge facts that were disqualifying. I mean, in this and other memos, we learned that in July of 2008, two people inside the Clinton Foundation, the HIV-AIDS fighting part of it, had diverted, allegedly, $23 million from the foundation. The controls were so bad, they could do that. And then, instead of firing those two people, Ira Magaziner and Anil Soni, the foundation said, no, 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 we'll cover this up. We'll steal, they use the word divert, money from a, quote, quasi-endowment, and we'll just cover it up. You can't do that. And, you know, this is all as Team Clinton. But they went ahead and did it. And so, you know, and then they jobbed, in my view, the Senate, and they have been jobbing the American public ever since. And we still don't know at this moment in time how it is, you know, should Hillary win, and she's, in some say, the leading contender and the shoo-in, should she win, how will the Clinton Foundation be in the conflicts with it, which are obvious now, thanks to WikiLeaks and others, how will these conflicts be curtailed under an administration where Hillary's the president and her team has ultimate prosecutorial discretion and the ability before that to decide what resources are even allocated towards an investigation of criminality? How will this foundation and the conflicts with the administration be regulated? Barack Obama certainly could do it. And, I mean, not he was capable of doing it, but he evidently decided not to do it and his team. How, if she wins, can the American people have any hope that these massive conflicts will stop? I don't think
they can. My theory is that Barack Obama is in on it, and Barack Obama's administration has been protecting Hillary Clinton for a long time. They knew and still do know the extent, much of it anyway, of the criminality associated with the Clinton Foundation. And it leads me further to believe that the Clintons had something. They have something on this man, and they used it very effectively to keep him and his entire administration in check. I mean, by the time this memorandum of understanding was floated, for example, Team Clinton and associates, the chairman, I believe it was, of Citibank. I'm not sure which of the name of it, which bank it was, whether it was Citi, had already delivered a list of, quote, suggestions for his administration's appointees, naming all the members that they preferred to see as members of his cabinet. And it turned out that it was exactly the same thing almost, that the suggestions turned out to be real. Obama made it real. So he was accustomed to playing ball with this gang. And we can't allow him off the hook. He's in on it. And his whole administration is in on it. Like today, we learned that the Justice Department has severely cut its staff that monitors elections. I mean, what are you trying to say? Why do you think people can't put two and two together? President Obama has been given orders, and he's following them. He is part of this, and we have to figure out. I was hoping that by now we will get some blazing documentation supporting that. But my news instinct says he is not an innocent bystander here. He is an active part, and his administration is an active part in running this ruse on the country, on the entire nation. So we're coming close to the end. You want to wrap up? Charles?
Well, I just say, I'll give you a quick minute or so that I think if we want to get to the bottom of that, we've got to look at the Barack Obama Foundation, the fundraising efforts for that, and the various groups that have been party to these Department of Justice settlements with the big financial institutions. The way the Obama administration has structured many of these is to require the big banks to make donations to these 501c3 community justice organizations. And as a guess, if we follow that trail, we're going to find ties to allies of Team Obama and a theory that post-presidency, he may have the ambition to take his own foundation to levels that the Clinton Foundation has not even dreamed of attaining.
Well, that's the other downside here, and this is why this thing must be pursued vigorously. The Clintons and their way of doing things have become so standardized now that you have to hold them responsible also for creating the environment in which this is standard political culture. The expectation is that you proceed with an interest in politics because you could make a lot of money under the table. And they are responsible, I think, for propagating that way of thinking and acting within government, abuse of power that way. We have to hold them accountable for that. That brings us to the end of the program today. I really, really appreciate your participation today, Charles. And every time that you're on the air, we learn a lot more. And sometimes it's very saddening, but it is, just in case people are wondering, these are facts. These are not just people, indulging in conjecture. These are facts. And it's a sad period that we're in. Very much so. Thanks again for being with us. Now, tomorrow, we'll see what happens on the big stage, where this goes, but I can assure you that it won't be over, even if they tell us it's over. It's not over. This country is on the precipice of doom, and it is a manufactured thing. It is something that a small clique had decided that they can do, and they have it in their minds that the American people are just plain stupid. And they're so smart, and they're so entitled, and they're so original in their ideas that they can pull this kind of thing. They can just loot the country and expose the country to the world as a cesspool of crime, a bunch of gangsters. This is organized crime. We can't back away from that at all. This is organized crime. The question is, will the key actors be made to pay for those crimes? We'll see what the jury says, that is the voters, tomorrow, and we'll see what the system says after tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Meditations and Molotovs with Vincent Emanuele. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. A pleasure always, and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.